Всем привет, я в Одессе.
Хотя место событий Одесса.
В Одессе проходит международный кинофестиваль.
Одесса единственный город, где были не просто...
Одессу сегодня посетил президент Украины
Порошенко. Очередной взрыв прогремел сегодня в Одессе.
Теракты в Одессе продолжаются.
Спокойную ночь жителям Одессы.
Кто хочет раскачать ситуацию в Одессе?
It's a place known for its wit and its humor, as well as for its crime and its corruption. Its location is highly strategic, and its symbolism is absolutely vital. Its fiercely independent residents proudly call it the freest Russian-speaking city in the world. Odessa is a city and a region that Ukraine's pro-Western authorities absolutely must get right if they're going to be successful. And they've placed it in the hands of one of the former Soviet Union's most colorful and controversial figures. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RVRL. Joining me here in the studio is Salome Asatiani, a correspondent and popular blogger with RFRL's Georgian service. Welcome to the podcast, Salome.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. And also joining us on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services and on organized crime, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hey there, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype from Odessa is blogger and political commentator Nikolai Holmov, author of the blog Odessa Talk. Welcome to the podcast, Nikolai.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to have you. And with us in spirit is Volodymyr Dubovik, a professor of international relations at Odessa's Mechnikov National University. I spoke to Volodymyr earlier in the week, and we'll be playing fragments of that interview throughout the program. One of the things I asked him about in our interview is how Odessa has changed over the past 18 months. And I think that's a good way to get the ball rolling. So let's get the ball rolling with that.
Odessans were kind of politically passive, often absenteeistic. Odessa was always lowest in this ranking of how many people voted in various elections and so on. People were always having this attitude of let us just adjust or adapt to whatever person or party that we have in power. You know, we'll be able to live through and somehow accommodate ourselves and so on. The Odessan thing of themselves as someone special, really. Someone having a special role or niche within Ukrainian society. A lot of people are still saying we're not quite Ukrainians, we're not quite Russians, we're Odessans. But actually the amount of people who are saying we are Ukrainians is growing since the whole trouble started. Since Euromaidan, since Crimea, since the beginning of war in Donbass. I think that proportionally speaking, the portion, the segment of population in the city and in the region, which is growing to be more pro-Ukrainian, actively pro-Ukrainian, and devotedly pro-Ukrainian, is growing in Odessa. Because there are many people who are now just being upset about their country being under attack. You know, it's actually united a lot of people with various political connotations because there were many people who voted various ways in Odessa. But since the beginning of Russian aggression, they're just upset. And I think that it's their duty, really, to come up to support Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Now, you know quite well that this depiction of Ukrainian crisis as some kind of a civil war, black and white, it's ethnic Russians against ethnic Ukrainians or Russian speakers against Ukrainian speakers, is just completely false, right? This narrative doesn't meet any of the reality that we're having with the crisis. You know, because there are millions and millions of ethnic Russians and Russian speakers in Ukraine who are strongly pro-Ukrainian and who take part in volunteer activities and fight in the war, in fact. If you listen to many interviews from the front lines, I think most of the people even, speak Russian.
And the Maidan was bilingual, and actually Russian was was close to the lingua franca of the Maidan, if I remember correctly.
Exactly. So for Putin, of course, with his Novorossiya, New Russia concept, it's very important that Odessa would be on their side, so to speak. But they failed, in fact. And I don't know what May 2nd was last year. Some people say it was an attempt to create another Luhansk, Donetsk, or Slavyansk out of Odessa. Others are saying it was the same kind of scenario minus little green man with machine guns. Mm. The difference was that in Odessa, a vast number of people came out against those separatist forces, really. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, as I said, that there was no massive invasion of well-armed and well-trained people like it was in many areas of Donbass. Because if you add to May 2nd events of last year, say, dozens or hundreds of well-trained people with machine guns in the streets of Odessa, that would be perhaps a different outcome and much more blood, and there'll be a massacre, obviously. Mm-hmm. But in terms of a proportion of the correlation of forces in Odessa, it showed to us that there is a very strong pro-Ukrainian core in the city. And most of these people spoke Russian, obviously.
Well, from one Odessan to another, Nikolai, you listened to what Volodymyr Dubovik had to say there. He said the city is basically becoming more patriotic, there's more civic consciousness, is becoming more actively pro-Ukrainian. And the tragic events at the trade union building last May 2nd kind of made this clear. Would you agree with his assessment? Has this crisis awakened Odessa's civic consciousness and its patriotism?
I would say the city is very much more visibly patriotic towards Ukraine. Flags are everywhere, inside cars, hanging off buildings, Ukraine-coloured bracelets, T-shirts, you name it, they're everywhere. It really is a dramatic shift from 2013, and highly visible, highly visible. It's a profound shift, in actual fact, visibly.
And was this brought on? Was this brought on by the Euromaidan, by the war in Donbass, by fears that this could happen in Odessa, by opposition to Putin, by support of the authorities in Kyiv? What's driving it?
I'll be quite honest. I went to a few Maidan demonstrations whilst the Yanukovych regime was still in power, and they were small, very very small, a few hundred people maximum. The invasion of Crimea and the illegal annexation caused a lot of people to make choices. That was probably the key. Normally, as Vladimir said, Odessa appears politically apathetic and generally will side with Kyiv, whichever way Kyiv is blowing. But Crimea changed everything. People were forced to choose sides, and the vast majority chose Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think that was? This is, again, an overwhelmingly ethnic Russian city, overwhelmingly ethnic Russian region. I lived in Odessa in the beginning of the 90s. It was one of the happiest years of my life, 93, 94. I missed the city dearly. But I didn't notice that people were particularly overly loyal to the Ukrainian state then. They thought of themselves as Odessans, as Volodymyr said. They were Russian speakers. Nobody spoke Ukrainian in Odessa when I was there. And I mean nobody. Nobody, at least, that I encountered. So what about that?
Well, you'll find that very few still speak Ukrainian as the first choice. Many, of course, can speak Ukrainian, but the first choice default language is Russian. But there are a lot of cross-cutting cleavages that negate language. Of course, you have ethnic Bulgarians, you have ethnic Jews, you have the Jewish community, the ethnic Germans, et cetera, ethnic Turks. So that there's a lot of cross-cutting cleavages that sideline the language issue to a degree. Mm-hmm. But I would say that...
Language didn't translate into political loyalty there for some reason.
No.
And this, this is not unique this way. This was the case in Dnipropetrovsk. This was the case in, surprisingly, in Kharkiv. Yes. And elsewhere in Mariupol, it was also the case. Odessa's not unique in this sense. But what was driving it in Odessa, do you think?
I think it's very much the violation of the self. Mm-hmm. It was a choice between choosing them or us, and us what came down as the side of Kyiv.
Mm. How about Odessa's kind of vaunted love of freedom? And I mean, I think Odessans, I noticed two things about Odessans when I were there, other than that they're very funny and they're very fun. They're very smart.
Yes.
And they're very libertarian. They want in the class, they want their freedom.
Yes.
And
do.
I think you put those two things together, and I think Odessans are smart enough to understand that their chances of continuing to be such a free city were better in a democratic, albeit imperfect, Ukraine than they were in an autocratic Russia. Would that be a correct assessment?
I would say that's very much hitting the nail firmly on the head.
glad to hear that. Mark, let's bring you in here. What are your thoughts here? And how important is it that Ukraine get Odessa right now? because we're going to get into that with Saakashvili and all.
Well, I think there's a danger in making Odessa too much. It is not a deal breaker. It will be great if it's got right, not just for economic but also for political reasons. Exactly because it's not a kind of, it's not Lviv or whatever. If Odessa can work well, then it's a sign that precisely a city that wasn't at the forefront of Maidan and such like can nonetheless benefit and be integrated into the society. But on the other hand, if Odessa is not a perfect success, that will not be a terrible, ruinous catastrophe. I think there is a risk of, in Jared Tanney's wonderful, wonderful book, City of Rogues and Schnorrers, about Odessa and so forth. He has this line about sort of, it's one of the imagined cities of golden sin. We have to beware of making it into a sort of imagined city of reform and probity, because it's never going to be either of those. I think the thing about Odessa is exactly, it is a cosmopolitan and perhaps most importantly mercantile city. That's been absolutely central to its identity. And in some ways, this was one of the reasons, in my opinion, for its lack of close connections with Kiev, when, as it were, Kiev was the regulating power. In a way, Odessa has often defined itself as being against the man, whoever the man may happen to be. Once upon a time, it was the Tsarist regime, then it was the Soviet regime, and then it became Kiev. These frankly stolid, lumpen, interfering, over-regulating, overbearing outsiders who try and tell us what to do. And then along came the blessed Russians in the Donbass, who precisely created a situation where just at the point when Kiev was in a position to reinvent itself, quite how successfully that'll work out, that's another matter for another podcast. But at the same time, you know, it was very clear that if you were going to have to make a choice between a Kiev that was certainly at least talking about deregulation, about passing powers to local authorities, about a lighter hand, and at the very same time when the Russians, which, let's be honest, it's hard to see, look at the Putin regime and think a lighter hand. In a way, exactly as Nick was saying, I mean, basically they were suddenly given this choice. And in that respect, as it were, if they were choosing between two men, two of the men, Kiev was a much, much less objectionable one. So I think really it's not that Odessa has changed in any way. I just think it's, as it were, the complexion of the offers that it was being given changed. I have to sort of bow to people who actually know the city from the inside. But my suspicion is, though, that this is a very, very conditional degree of loyalty. Mm. It's not actually, I mean, yeah, I hear what you're saying about sort of the sudden flowering of blue and yellow throughout Odessa and such like. But on the other hand, I think that probably Kiev is going to have to play Odessa very carefully. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The current emergency is precisely that. It is a current emergency. It cannot and will not last forever. And if Kiev then starts to once again return to Kiev's old ways, which, let's be honest, are, you know, if we looked at past opportunities, I mean, Kiev has always drifted back into being corrupt, heavy-handed, and essentially a burden rather than a benefit to the rest of the country. Well, then I think at that point, Odessans will once again go back to their good old ways of essentially subverting, bypassing, and ignoring whatever comes from the center.
Well, so basically, we can credit Putin with accomplishing the impossible here. They've turned Odessa into a city that's supporting the man. And while we're talking about the man, let's talk about the man's man, the man who's been put in charge of this city. And this is, again, a colorful man for a colorful city. Former Georgian president Mikhail Saakashvili. I spoke a little bit with Volodymyr Dubovik about this, about his insights, about how he approached and how Odessans responded to this, what was a bit of a surprising appointment. We'll see how it works out. But let's listen to what Volodymyr had to say about the appointment of Saakashvili and how he approached it as an Odessan. How would you assess Saakashvili's performance so far? He's a very controversial figure. Yeah. He's a controversial figure in Georgia. Yeah. And he's a very colorful figure, for a colorful city, I would add. But how would you assess how he's performed so far?
That's an interesting question, of course. When he was appointed, the first reactions were often extreme. And I took an issue with this, you know, because some people on one hand were saying, oh, that's such a terrible appointment. He's not fitting what he's doing there. He's going to shatter this fragile piece of Odessa. He's going to irritate Russia. It's not good because it's next door to Transnistria. And look at his record in Georgia. He promised reforms, but then he basically deteriorated into some kind of soft authoritarian system and so on. And then on the other extreme, people were euphoric and saying, oh, finally, this well-known man who is well-known for his PR campaigns, who has a lot of his big persona, larger-than-life personality, really. He's coming in. He has some credentials in reforming Georgia. So Georgia has been seen, as you know, for a number of years as a success story, a poster boy in post-Soviet transformation business. So people were euphoric, and I said from the very beginning in these debates in various places in social media and elsewhere that, well, wait a minute, let's have a wait-and-see approach, first of all. Let's see what he can accomplish. And also, let's not try to have it black and white. You know, it's going to be difficult for him. He is not a tsar of Odessa or Ukraine. He's a governor of Odessa region. He's appointed by president. It's not elected position. He's not going to have this term in power guaranteed for him. How much he can accomplish within one particular administrative territorial unit of Ukraine, that's another question. How he can get along with some power strongmen, the power players in Odessa, in Ukraine, that's another thing. How he's going to get along with oligarchs. Is it going to be a war or something else? Is it going to be some cohabitation? So there are many issues, and I think it's kind of early still to make a final judgment on how successful he is. Because I've seen these people saying, okay, let's have this conference on 50 days of power in Saakashvili, or then 100 days of Saakashvili. Mm-hmm. You don't do things so fast when you're in Ukraine. Things move slowly. And, you know, we're in the south, so we have the southern mentality. So think of Italians, you know, think of Greeks. Sometimes, if you want to understand what's going on in Odessa, it's not happening fast, but he's moving in the right direction. The PR I definitely like. The team reformers that he has assembled, I do like. I call it jokingly some kind of Noah's Ark of reforms in Odessa that he has assembled. All of these reformers on one boat, basically.
Right.
Yeah, and then he's talking to the people. He is very open. He's very transparent. He's making right decisions in that respect, because the previous governors, we didn't really see them too much, not on TV, nor in public, nor being capable of actually talking to them in the streets of Odessa. So he's moving in the right direction. He's trying to achieve some small things first, and I think that's the right way to do, deliver some minor achievements for the time being, because the people are thinking about great projects and stuff like grand projects and stuff like that. But do little things, step by step, baby steps. You know, one beach is being taken away and the public now has access. Fine. There is a new agreement that open skies for the Odessa region, so the budget airlines could come to Odessa. That's great for many of Odessans who would like to travel and spend less on travel to Europe or elsewhere. You know, things like that. If he can fix the roads, somehow the roads is always an important issue. Not just in Odessa, but in Odessa region, there are some highways that are particularly terrible, awful, specifically in the western part of Odessa Oblast, coming towards Danube cities of Izmail and Rini and so on. So he promised to do something about it. And so far he's been successful in terms of lobbying Odessa region interests on a central level, you know, coming with his personality and his influence, and people know that he is close to the president. It helps, you know, so he comes to some certain officials in Kyiv, and he asks or demands for some favors for the region. You know, how sustainable is it in the longer run? That's another issue, but he's moving in the right direction.
Right. So we have a cautiously optimistic assessment there from Volodymyr Dubovik of Miechkov National University. Salome, you've watched this man, Mikhail Saakashvili's career from the very, very start in Georgia. The good, you've seen the good, you've seen the bad. You've seen the ugly. You've seen the silly. You've seen the whole gamut when it comes to the Mikhail Saakashvili show. What do you think Odessans can expect from this man going forward, given what you know?
It is a very difficult question, and I believe one that cannot really be answered realistically, because, first of all, history doesn't always repeat itself, and even if it does, we know what happens the first time and the second time that it repeats itself. And then I also think that these are two very different contexts. Odessa, mm-hmm. Saakashvili in Odessa is a different politician than he was in Georgia. In Georgia, he was, of course, elected president. He had a huge mandate, huge public trust. He was an insider there. He's an appointed official, an outsider. I really cannot say now what Odessans can expect from him as a sort of overall large picture. But certainly what is clear already that he's been trying to position himself as someone who will fight corruption in this notoriously corrupt region, even with post-Soviet standards, and that he will bring some huge reforms. This is all that we as Georgians have, of course, experienced firsthand. In Georgia, of course, when the Rose Revolution happened, 2003, in the last years of Shevardnadze's rule, Georgia was engulfed by corruption. I mean, it was... Mm. It was virtually on the verge of becoming a failed state. Corruption. Pensioners were getting pension of $7 per month, and even that, those $7 weren't being paid because it was being embezzled by public, some official structures. Like officials were openly and unapologetically corrupt. This was really culturally striking feature of late Shevardnadze era. They were building mansions. They were going, I mean, safari hunting, and where people were just, you know, in dire poverty, the almost entire population. So we had constant energy blackouts, schools and classrooms were freezing in winter, so on and so forth. So the era of Rose Revolution, when it started, it was very, very rapid change on a massive scale and very positive change, of course. And it's now a well-known story, and I won't go into detail. There are anti-corruption efforts that were successful in many areas, and World Bank also noted 8 of these areas: patrol police, tax collection, customs, power provision, business deregulation, public and civil registries, university entrance exams, municipal services. I mean, in university, you had to either know someone, your parents had, I remember that firsthand, mm-hmm. as a school pupil and then as a student, that you had to have either contacts or bribe somebody. Otherwise, you would never make it to university. This was like in the very beginning, 2003, 2004. These were massive, massive positive changes. Of course, the changing the notoriously corrupt police, the traffic mm-hmm. police in Georgia, with this flashy, good-looking, polite patrol police driving around in cars. This was, they understood that patrol police, bureaucracy, these were the elements that citizens had day-to-day, everyday contact with. So they understood that it was really very important to start the changes from these structures. And so, yes, they were drastic, positive changes, and this was really very important. And these changes have lingered. However, you want to ask me something?
No. I want you to get to your however first, because I'll come back in with my question in a second.
Yeah, this is a big however. Democracy in Georgia paid a big price for these reforms and developmental projects. Now, of course, in order to execute these reforms in a fast and swift manner, power had to be concentrated at the hands of the executive branch of the government, and this pretty much became synonymous with Saakashvili, with the man himself. It was clear from the very early years that he and maybe a couple of people, like his most closest allies, were the sole decision makers in the country. And
we used to joke about Misha's 11, you know, his little
I'm not even sure if they were 11 or they were 3 or 4. Yes, absolutely. There was no, of course, checks and balances. Branches of the government just existed to reinforce his power. Media was restricted. And this authoritarian or the features became increasingly strong in their way of governance. And so that all culminated in the brutal crackdown on peaceful opposition demonstrations, of course, and then our prison systems, which were in a deplorable state. Torture was very widespread. We will talk about the fight with organized crime later, but the crackdown on crime and corruption resulted in one of the highest incarceration rates in worldwide mm-hmm. for Georgia. So the positive side of the reforms had a big shadow, negative side as well. And in my personal opinion, Saakashvili personally, this is my really personal opinion, I don't know how many Georgians would share this with me, but he and his quest for power was the biggest problem for Georgia, and the biggest problem for his own party, National Movement. I believe this is what caused the Rose Revolution momentum to stagnate, because really, since 2007, no reforms were being executed anymore. He was becoming increasingly populist, intolerant, authoritarian. And this was a very negative factor for his party as well, that they still haven't been able to choose a successor to Saakashvili. They still, even if Saakashvili now is official in Ukraine, he has given up Georgian citizenship, his party continues to exist in his shadow. So just to wrap up, I think this is something that many Georgians would agree with me, probably. We really want him to succeed in Odessa for many reasons. Of course, we understand that Odessa and Ukraine and Georgia is part of the same narrative, same scenario, the same attempt to break out from Putin's imperialist visions of the region and his close neighborhood, or the way he views it. And it's extremely important that Odessa, as an important part of Ukraine, gets it right. And also it will be beneficial for Georgia as well. But we also hope that he'll be successful so that he might not return to Georgia.
Well, that's a lukewarm endorsement if I've ever heard one. But
I think he's dreaming about it. He has been talking about even sailing from Odessa to Batumi. His triumphant trip. He hasn't given up hope, and I don't think his return, Misha now for Georgia, I don't think it will be a good perspective.
But Nikolai is an Odessan, and as you hear Salome talking, and I'm sure you're not hearing this for the first time, but what's your assessment so far of Saakashvili, and where do you fit in this dichotomy that Volodymyr Dubovik pointed out for us, and those people who are wildly enthusiastic about this or who are approaching with serious trepidation?
Oh, no, I'm an old man. I wait for dust to settle.
But how would you assess him so far?
He's got his good and bad points. So far, he's been very good at town halls. Actually, he's probably the most visible and most physically met governor Odessa's ever had when it comes to going out to Izmail or other far-flung regions of the oblast. He's gone. Previous governors have only ever been seen on TV by the residents there. One of the benchmarks I would probably throw out there will be the local elections in October. As we talked about before, Odessa can drift. Its support is conditional. And as was said, there was a stagnation following Maidan, where nothing happened in Odessa. You just heard the word reform repeated from Kyiv on your TV, but nothing physically changed in Odessa. Whether part of the equation in throwing him as governor into Odessa was to generate some movement before the October elections, thereby increasing Kyiv's chances of having friendly leaderships, shall we say, in the districts, is something worth considering, because there was certainly a lack of momentum, shall we say, behind Kyiv starting to creep in. So if that's why he's been sent, one of the first benchmarks will be the October elections. But before that, he needs to deliver something. His one-stop shop for business is supposed to start on the 1st of October, 27 days before the elections, which will get a lot of local coverage, of course. Now, the timing we can put down to political expediency, I see no reason why it couldn't have started 1st of July. We are talking about a single location for bureaucracy to be done, after all. It's not a major administrative event. The other issue I have possibly is that he seems to be moving strategically quickly against the clock, and we will probably see the law catch up later on. Certain events are, shall we say, legitimately questionable that have occurred. So there will be a concern, knocking down the wall at the beach being very popular, but from the legal perspective, there are certain clauses in the law where the defendant, shall we say, has a set amount of time to make his case, and it wasn't given, and the wall was just knocked down. Other people have been removed from office by him, which technically he wasn't allowed to do, although he claims in one particular case he had the permission of the infrastructure ministry to remove a certain individual. The fact is, it should have been the infrastructure ministry that dismissed him, or at least suspended him. So the law may well catch up with his strategy of swift and visible change. which is another issue that will come about, maybe, kind of. Mm-hmm. Aside from that, I mean, he does give the impression of whack a crook or whack a corrupt scheme on the TV. But behind that, and which is not particularly well put into the public view, is there is some serious structural changes going on by a very good team behind him. And structure and sustainability will matter, especially in a post-Misha Odessa.
Mm, right.
Yeah, I mean, people.
So the team he's tasted, because that's what I was going to ask you. How about the team he's brought in? We've all, you know, Maria Gaidar was of course the most high profile of those. But he has brought a whole team of people there.
Yeah.
Some of them from Georgia, some of them from elsewhere. So how would you say he's put a good team together?
He's put an effective team together. There are certainly. I mean, the rollout of Miss Gaidar was a bit of a PR disaster with her. Mm-hmm. She wasn't prepped for the obvious questions about the war in the Donbass and the issue of Crimea. She came out with the usual fraternal brotherhood quotes, which was Kremlin-esque technology as it was received here, of course. So that didn't go down well. So she's
recovered now, since, though.
She's recovered. But, I mean, that was a bit of a PR disaster, which you could have foreseen the most obvious questions. The other issue is he does have a lot of volunteers. He appealed for Western-educated local people to volunteer to help the administration, and there was a huge response. I know of at least 80 that are still waiting to be interviewed, but this is 2 months on, which is not necessarily the right perception you want to give volunteers, a two-month wait, and you're still not even seen.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's not down to him. That's down to the team behind him. Of course, he doesn't personally interview everybody, but when you make such an appeal as governor, your team behind you has to be a little bit more efficient than having people still waiting
right.
2 months down the line and getting holding emails every couple of weeks.
Right. Mark, let's get you in here. Definitely have, I'm sure you have an opinion about the appointment of Saakashvili and his performance so far. This is a guy that's kind of hard to ignore. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, when do I not have an opinion on most things? I think when it comes down to it again, and I think sort of Nick, it was right to actually raise, in some ways, we have to think about Saakashvili as a sort of a media phenomenon, and Saakashvili in terms of the institutional shifts that are taking place in his, I think it's fair to call it, reign. I mean, just to start with some of the sort of the fundamental and structural issues, I mean, Salome was absolutely right in raising the point of actually this is a very, very different context from in Georgia. That in Georgia he had the legitimacy and the mandate of an election, where here he has just been sort of parachuted in. In Georgia he was supported by a lot of Georgians. The difference is, of course, that his team in Odessa is comprising of a lot of Georgians. I mean, I think that it is a sort of slightly strange paradox that actually in the name of a patriotic revolution, Odessa has largely been handed to Georgians. So maybe we should be talking about Georgian imperialism more than anything else. But that does have an issue. I mean, that does raise an issue about precisely how, in the long term, the optics of Saakashvili will be portrayed. Because, yes, he is making a lot of promises and making a big splash. And, of course, it's lovely in an optics sense to have a governor who goes out and meets the people a lot. And certainly it's better that than a governor who is wholly insulated and has no idea what people are thinking and how they're living or whatever. But it also, again, creates certain expectations. Now, the thing is that this is a man who, after all, does not play well with others. It's fine to have a team below him, but he doesn't have a tendency to work well with people on a lateral level. And here I think there are going to be sort of three particular complexities. One is how he deals with the Odessan elite. And obviously we're particularly talking about Odessa Mayor Gennady Trokhanov, who after all is a classic old school, opportunistic, but competent in his own realm figure. And so there is already a very clear sort of tussle are emerging there. Secondly is how Saakashvili works with Kiev. Yeah, at the moment he's been able to leverage his position, his profile, and his bullish personality to get what he wants out of Kiev. But there has to come a point, because, and this is the third one, and this is the area that I think hasn't been explored at all, is at the moment one of the reasons why Odessa is doing relatively well is exactly that it has been given a privileged position. That Saakashvili has been allowed to get away with a lot of things that other regional governors would not. And Saakashvili has had resources from both international donors, you know, such as the United States, but also from Kiev that a lot of other regions have not. How far are people going to start thinking, hang on, Odessa is eating the opportunities of us, the rest of the regions? And again, I mean, in some ways, this is, as it were, the foreign policy of being a regional governor. And here I see Saakashvili making no real efforts to do anything. So, I mean, I think there are some substantial political problems in the future. So the question becomes, in a way, is he able to bed down sufficient genuine institutional improvements? And ideally ones that are actually within the law. That's nice. It is very nice if you want to try to create a law-based state, if you do it legally. And certainly not then end up being tied up in lengthy reviews and sort of, you know, court cases in the future. So now, how far can you create the institutional basis before, to be blunt, Saakashvili being Saakashvili catches up with him? Right. And all the promises and all the glitz and all the one-man Vojdism and all these other various sort of problems that we saw in Georgia will, as I think is almost invariably the case, they will come up and consume him. It's a question of how much good he can do before that point.
Right, and this is where these two contexts might end up being tragically very, very, very similar, and we got to hope that doesn't happen. One more issue I wanted to touch on before we went into the second half and talk about crime and corruption is the issue of pro-Moscow sentiments in Odessa. They exist in small numbers, but they exist. And when I spoke to Volodymyr Dubovik, I asked him how much of a problem this is going to be. Let's listen to what he had to say.
I think it is a bit of a problem, obviously. I mean, we're not, you know, we should distinguish really some operatives, some people who are trained to do trouble and damage and make some subversive acts and so on. Who are trained to do explosions and stuff. We had our share of explosions, as you know, in Odessa, dozens of those. Luckily enough, only one fatality so far late last year, when actually, presumably, it was a guy who was carrying the device who got killed. Otherwise, it's just more of an intimidation campaign. Mm-hmm. Doors and windows being blown up of the offices of organizations being involved in helping the war effort. In the east of Ukraine, but those people are there. They're not really visible. You know, there are many leaders who are in hiding since events of May 2nd last year, who went to Russia or elsewhere. Some went to Crimea. So, but I guess there is some cells that are in place, and they would wait some sleeper cells, and they would wait for some signals. Mm-hmm. So therefore, I would say there is an opportunity for more trouble in Odessa. That's why I always say that the stability that we have now in Odessa, the peace, it's relative. The tranquility is fragile. You know, you can still shatter the glass, unfortunately, in Odessa, if you really try hard, if you put the money, the effort, if you give instructions to those people. There are people around. One of my Russian colleagues once called them professional Russians. You know, they're basically making money out of this. You know, the Odessa was...
But they're locals. They're locals.
Was a major, yeah, there's some locals, some coming from outside, mostly Ukrainian citizens, yes. Right. And Odessa was a major battlefield, really, between pro-Russian, pro-Ukrainian forces, even before Euromaidan. You know, because all of these identities were shifting and colliding in Odessa, and there was a debate going on. The only thing that was before the recent events, it was always peaceful, right? Mm-hmm. And specifically since May 2nd, events of last year, you know, it's not peaceful anymore. So the violence, so the innocence is broken. It's not there anymore. The blood was shed in Odessa in that tragic event last year. You know, but the people are there. They're not really visible. The pro-Ukrainian activists are much more visible. Some of this pro-Russian camp, the people who were whose mentality and attitudes were shaped by Russian media, you know, they would still think that the Kyiv government should do more to provide more rights for Russian speakers. Even though I'm being myself a Russian speaker, I've always been puzzled by that. I mean, because I've never seen an example of Russian speakers being persecuted or discriminated against in Ukraine, including in Odessa. You know, even I, being a pro-Ukrainian person, most of my lectures I do in my university in Russian, because I just know that it's going to be a little bit easier for my students to understand me if I do it in Russian. So I've never seen any examples of persecution or discrimination. But for some people who live this alternative reality, virtual reality, you know, they see the life in Ukraine, even though they live in Ukraine, through the prism of what they see on Russian TV, right? That's hard to understand for some people outside of Ukraine, but that's how it is for years. You know, they would still talk about this Russian language issue and how the government is not doing enough, how the rights of Russian speakers are being endangered and so on.
Nikolai, what about that? Volodymyr raises two things here. There's the what he calls the professional Russians, the professional troublemakers. And then there's this portion of the Odessa region that, you know, gets their information from Russian TV and has this imaginary belief that Russian speakers are being discriminated against, which would, I don't know if Odessa linguistically is the same as it was when I lived there, but if you were going to oppress Russian speakers in Odessa, you would have to oppress the entire region, right? But what your reaction on both of those scores?
Yeah, I would agree. First of all, I'd agree with you about the language point. I don't know anybody that speaks Ukrainian as their first language in Odessa. I'm sure there must be. I just don't know them. But 99.9% speak Russian first and foremost, at home and at work and at play. So the language issue really is a bit of a...
But there's people that think it's an issue?
Not that I know of.
Right,
but
I really didn't come across anybody who even thought it was an issue.
No, no. I mean, not that I'm aware of. Professional Russians, well... Yes.
You wrote on your blog about Bessarabia and this attempt to create this I called it Bessarabia, son of Novorossiya, on the Daily Vertical,
which is very much what it is now. The Bessarabia region is a rather interesting spot at the moment. Of course, you've got certain interests trying to force the Bessarabian People's Republic.
But does this have any legs? I mean, I didn't think it did.
No. It's become more difficult, actually, as it appears that financing has been severely removed from the pro-Russian narrative at the moment. That may well have something to do with Mr. Shipko, the former consular general, being person non grated not so long ago. He was sent here in March 2014 at the annexation of Crimea and removed a couple of months ago. Since then, bombings and the like have reduced dramatically.
Uh-huh.
Now quite what role the Russian consulate had in that is...
People can draw their own conclusions.
Exactly. I mean, you don't get PNG'd for nothing, let's be quite frank. And he hasn't been replaced.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would also say the weather has a lot to do with the bombings retreating at the present. It's a lot harder to carry a bomb around in your shorts and vest than it is in a dark coat on a dark night. Anyway, it's just something that strikes me as come October, November, we may see a return.
Do you think, I mean, are these professional Russians a potential problem? Could they shatter the fragile peace in Odessa? Or is it something that really just doesn't have any legs?
I don't think it has a lot of legs, but I think it's potentially an ongoing problem. Something that will obviously keep the Western media entertained. You know, Odessa's on the brink once more.
Right.
Et cetera, feed the narrative, and obviously in Russia itself and Crimea. But you look at terrorist incidents, and terrorism rarely succeeds in achieving what it wants. It always ends up in a political process, and pro-Russian sentiment has not the political legs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Okay. Well, Mark, any last thoughts before we move on to your forte in the second part?
Well, in some ways, I think exactly. I think this is precisely a hinge point, because I see very, very little evidence in Odessa that there is any kind of genuine constituency, either for protecting poor endangered Russians, let alone for some sort of closer relationship with the Russian heartland. And instead, what one could call professional Russians, I could just as easily call essentially criminal mercenaries, seem to be being engaged. And this is one of the areas in which precisely crime and politics have become fairly inextricably linked.
Well, that's a beautiful way to segue, Mark. I like that. Thank you for that. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the role that crime and corruption has historically played in Odessa and at Saakashvili's chances of tackling it. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is Salome Asatiani of RFRL's Georgian Service. Joining us on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert on Russian organized crime and security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Odessa is blogger and political commentator Nikolai Holmov, author of the blog Odessa Talk. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
В шумном городе Одессе годца. Много там блатных и фраеров. Там заборы служат вместо прессы годца. Девки любят карты и вино.
And that's Arkady Severny with a famous Odessa crime ballad. From heroin to stolen cars to contraband weapons to trafficked women, Odessa's port has long been a smuggler's haven of choice on the Black Sea, as you put it in an article last year, Mark. You also noted that Odessa's criminal authorities have historically had, quote, more than a nodding relationship with the city's legitimate authorities, and that the main criminal business through Odessa is on behalf, directly or indirectly, of the Russian networks. Is that changing, Mark? You wrote that article a year ago, and you made some interesting predictions in that article. It was shortly after the annexation of Crimea. You were wondering if the business in Odessa was going to shift to Sevastopol. What do you see happening in the last year in Odessa in terms of all this?
Well, yeah, it certainly is interesting the extent to which we now see there being a, shall we say, an insurgent criminal power, Sevastopol, trying to cut into the business in Odessa, the criminal business. And as a result, in a way, two separate processes taking place within Odessa. One is a genuine attempt to try and sort of bring greater transparency and law and order and fight corruption and so forth. And at the second time, you actually have the criminal interests basically trying to ensure that they are as attractive as possible as a smuggling entrepot. Now, the point is, the way you do that is one of two ways. Either you offer security or you offer cheap rates. Now, the problem from the criminals' point of view, and obviously we need not shed any tears for them, is that precisely the whole Saakashvili drive towards cutting down on corruption and smuggling, which, after all, some frankly slightly back of the paper of the some back of the envelope calculations have suggested is worth anything from half to $1 billion annually in terms of lost revenues. Always be aware when you such nice round figures. But so on the one hand, you have an attempt to crack down on that, which means that, as it were, security is less of an issue. There is a slight uptick in, for example, the number of smuggled cargoes being intercepted. So instead, you have to basically start offering cheap rates. And so this is what we're seeing. We're seeing what is, in effect, a price war taking place between the Crimean and the Odessa smuggling hubs. For who can do the business more cheaply, which cuts into the criminals'
margins. So it's driving the price of a bribe down, is essentially what we're
talking about? Well, bribes and just generally, as it were, the cut that the local gangsters and their sort of businesses and so forth take for acting as a transshipment hub. Now, again, what this means is that the final sort of knock-on is, firstly, it means that they have a little bit less money to bribe themselves. But also, it means that it starts to cut into their profit margins. Now, either that means that they have to look for different areas to make money, or it means that you actually start getting the risk of turf wars. If there's less business, then actually it's more likely that the gangs will then start competing for what limited business there is. And that, I think, is something we're beginning to see. I think part of the kind of the campaigns of bombings and so forth we've seen is not actually anything to do with a Russian-sponsored campaign of terror, though that is still obviously the primary thing. But I think slightly rolled in with that are the beginnings of some low-level turf wars taking place within Odessa.
Mm-hmm. Nikolai, do you see evidence of that?
Oh, yes. Yes, for sure. There was one particular bombing that happened just after around Christmas time. There was certainly nothing to do with pro-Russian sentiment. It was a definite business spat between an ex-SBU officer and another, shall we say, without wanting to give names. That was somebody's premise, business premises was bombed during the middle of the pro-Russian bombing campaign, and obviously tried to pass off as such, whereas within 25 minutes of the bombing occurring, the whole underworld knew exactly who'd sent what message to who. So, yes, you certainly cannot say every bombing has been pro-Russia orientated. There's been at least three, possibly four, that have been underworld orientated business. Mm.
So that points to the potential kind of turf war that Mark's talking about that we might see.
We may well do.
Yeah. One thing, as Mark, as you were talking, that came into my mind is that we might have something of a perfect storm here. If Saakashvili and his team are serious about cleaning up the port and cleaning up corruption in Odessa, that's going to make it harder for organized crime to do business in Odessa, one would think, right? And if you have the port of Sevastopol opening up as an alternative, which one would presume, since we're basically talking about Russian organized crime groups, we're going to find an area controlled by Moscow much more amenable to them doing business. Don't you think we might just see this all move to Sevastopol, and this might be a perfect storm? It won't do much to decrease global smuggling, crime and corruption, but it might be very good for Odessa, no?
Well, we first of all have to be aware that actually it's not as though all the business can shift to Sevastopol. Firstly, because actually there's a lot of people who won't currently ship to and from Crimea for reasons of sanctions and everything else. Secondly, not everything goes by port. I mean, there's also the region's land border with Transnistria, which is a sort of a particularly key issue. And interestingly enough, I mean, Saakashvili is very keen on using some of the revenues that he can accrue to build a highway to Romania, to Rani. Now, again, if we look at other places where they've managed to open sort of good quality communication links into European countries, what that is a ka-ching moment for the smugglers. So to an extent, we actually just simply might see a certain amount of shifting from sea to land. But the main thing is, look, in the long term, obviously, fighting crime is a good thing. However, in the short term, it's usually a cost rather than a benefit. Firstly, because, I mean, it's nice to have your new shiny police academy uniformed police officers and so forth. But that actually costs money. Either you're going to have fewer police officers because you're paying them more, or you'll have to find other ways of economizing. There's a limit to how much sort of Western aid is going to provide. Secondly, this is sort of conversations with people actually involved in Odessa and law enforcement, who suggest that something like anything up to 10 to 15% of the value of shipping through Odessa is in some ways or another criminal. Either it's a directly criminal good, or else it's, you know, maybe something that's skipping exor, you know, it's not paying its proper export taxes or whatever. One way or the other, 10 to 15% of value. Obviously, that's not claimed as 10% of shipping. I mean, because a ton of legal goods is generally worth a lot less than a ton of illegal goods. But so if you are actually going to start cutting down on that, what you're actually also saying to Odessa, at a time when, you know, let's face it, there is a substantial immiseration across Ukraine as a whole, is, well, in the short term, that's actually going to mean less revenue to the city and to the region. So I think for all these reasons, it's not just going to annoy organized crime. It's actually going to have a serious impact on the port city. And at the same time, there is this final point, is that there is a challenge. Saakashvili wants to make Odessa into a free port. He sees it as it's got a Black Sea, Singapore. That's great. That means obviously deregulation, quick turnarounds and so forth, which actually tends to work against careful monitoring of goods and so forth. We've seen, for example, that Odessa is at the forefront of taking advantage of the new legalization of casinos to create casinos, which, you know, one could also describe as money laundering hubs. I mean, I think so actually Saakashvili already has a tension. On the one hand, he wants to cleanse Odessa, which is going to cost money. But on the other hand, his free market principles mean that in some ways he's actually going to be doing things which are going to be quite advantageous to the criminals. So what we might just simply see is a shift from certain forms of smuggling to other forms of smuggling, from certain forms of criminality to other forms of criminality. Mm. Gangsters are, if nothing else, tremendously entrepreneurial. And Saakashvili is, after all, the friend of the entrepreneur.
Salome, we both know that Saakashvili has a very mixed record on this in Georgia, and like he did on everything else. He reformed reforming the police, reigning in corruption, fighting organized crime, where he locked up all the Vor Zakonia in a space of a couple of weeks, if I remember correctly. But there was also some costs, some big failures to that. So would weigh in on this.
Yeah, mixed is a good word, I suppose. Like we already spoke about the undeniable change, the patrol police, which has remained pretty much the only unit of the whole law enforcement structures that was viewed positively by Georgian citizens. The other units, the other structures were increasingly brutal and politicized law enforcement structures were pretty much instrumental for maintaining central power, Saakashvili's power. The judiciary in Georgia was in very bad state. Prosecutors always had big advantage over defense, and most of the people who were accused of criminal charges were either being found guilty, then there was a big percentage of plea bargaining. So this is one big issue, big problems with the Georgian judiciary system. As soon as they came to power, of course, in 2003, 2004, they started arresting Shevardnadze-era officials and confiscating their gains. And, of course, Georgia's budget money grew and grew as many officials were giving up their millions because they wanted their freedom, obviously. But there was always the problems were persistent from the outset, very little transparency to what was confiscated, how it was used, why, and you know, very little due process, so to speak. And then, of course, in 2006, we had the big shakeup, the high-profile murder case of Georgian banker Sandro Girgliani, who was beaten and left to die by high-ranking police officials.
And that pointed to unaccountability on the part of
that made it clear, pretty much, to many Georgian citizens that Georgia was not on a path of rule of law and justice. So Girgliani's case is, of course, one of the charges Saakashvili faces in Georgia. He's accused of conspiring with other former senior officials to obstruct justice in this murder case.
And this is a banker, for those who are unfamiliar with the case, who insulted the wife of the interior minister, and then he was taken out
and killed some other officials in a Tbilisi restaurant. And then he was kidnapped, taken, and severely beaten and tortured and killed.
What about the organized crime aspect? Because he really, I mean, that is one thing that looks like a success if you look at it from the outside.
Yes, organized crime, and we have to a little bit, I'll try to be as fast as possible, but the context in Georgia was really very difficult when it comes to organized crime, and particularly when it comes to the so-called thieves in law, Voriv Zakonia, because at the close of the Soviet era, one-third of the thieves in law, the elite of these professional criminals, were Georgian in throughout Soviet Union, whereas Georgians represented about 2% of the entire population.
Right.
So this is statistics
so
given by one researcher.
Disproportionately represented. Right?
Yes. Louise Shelley gives these statistics, and I think it's really very telling because that institution, the thieves in law, that was not just a problem of the state or just a criminal problem. It was pretty much a cultural problem because it was very much accepted and cultivated and romanticized even and seen as manly or masculine or whatnot or just and so on and so forth. So, of course, during the Soviet era, as we all know, the thieves were supposed to have their rules, their codes, so they were not supposed to cooperate with the state in any form. However, as we also know from many prison records, they were from the very outset instrumentalized by the state, and they were controlling political prisoners in the gulags and getting privileged status in return. But after Stalin's death, obviously, as again we all know, the organized crime returned to the Soviet society, and the rules changed as well. Organized crime network became focused on rule evasion, participating in underground private businesses and exploitation of the state, which was very rampant in Georgia. And in Georgia, we had one figure, Jaba Ioseliani, who I think personifies all the moral wrongs that was happening in Georgian society at the time. He was a very famous thief in law. He had a Soviet-wide influence. He had been incarcerated many times in many prisons. He then led one of the militias, Khedrioni, in Georgia, played a key role in the overthrow of Georgia's first president, Viadgam Sakhurdia. And he was one of the key figures who invited Shevardnadze to come to Georgia and become president. So that shows how to what extent the crime and those networks had infiltrated Georgian political or right. governance structures. Of course, it was in Shevardnadze's times, and he went to prison again. Shevardnadze broke off with him. But still, the problem was huge. And Saakashvili's government cracked down really heavily on the institutions of the thieves in law. A special law was passed in 2005, which criminalized the actual status of being a thief in law. Being one was already a criminal act, and it allowed also confiscation of assets, and many crime bosses ended in prisons. And culturally, yes, we've experienced a shift. It is no longer romantically viewed by large segments of society, that institution. But I don't know to what extent we can say that this is all because of the Saakashvili era reforms. I also, yes, these were important, but I think it was also a matter of time. Mm-hmm. I just don't think there would...
So Georgian society was maturing and getting beyond this, and Saakashvili came
along. And also the thieves
time.
In law were the absolutely... you saw them more on television. You saw the people who couldn't speak two sentences properly. So it was really difficult to start to romanticize them or to believe in old beliefs. So yes, it was a mixture. Many different factors played a role. And yes, this is really, really fortunate and beneficial that institution has gone on the margins. It hasn't disappeared, of course, but it's not it doesn't play a central role in Georgian society.
It would probably be a criminal act to talk about Voris Zakonia and not bring Mark Galeotti into the discussion. So Mark, your thoughts on what Salome had to say there?
Just very briefly, absolutely. I mean, Saakashvili, he was both a symptom and a cause of the downfall of the canonieri, the Georgian Vori Vazakonia. But I think we have to realize it's not though organized crime has disappeared in Georgia.
No, of course not.
I mean, what Saakashvili did was destroy that, as it were, that kind of socially constructed and frankly, yes, fairly sort of unruly, old school type of crank gangster. And what you now have just simply is a sort of a new and much more recognizable, normal kind of organized crime figure who's linked in with the business and political worlds and busy filling voids in governance and meeting shadowy needs of supply and demand. So again, I think, you know, we have to realize Saakashvili accomplished something, absolutely. But because he failed to also address the governance issues adequately,
and provide the rule of law and fair justice system, which was key.
Precisely.
To get
but for all these reasons, therefore, you just simply, I mean, you had a changing of the guard and a new guard that is, you know, much more amenable, much better. I mean, you know, if I was a Georgian and had to choose between a new model gangster or the old model gangsters, I'd go with the new ones. but we have to appreciate the limitations of what actually Saakashvili was able to accomplish.
Do we see, and let's get both Mark and Nick on this, do we see a similar shift in Odessa in terms of the kind of criminality we're seeing? Either whoever wants to go first.
Yes. As has been made clear by Mark, it's now very difficult to separate organized crime from oblast corruption from politics. Mm. We mentioned the current mayor earlier on, who's openly admitted to being an associate of Alexander Anghart, also known as Angel, one of the top mafia bosses ever to walk the oblast. He's also the mayor's also connected to Vladimir Galaternik, also known as Lampchka, because he started laundering money through his light bulb shop in the 90s and now owns half of Arcadia and most of Langeron Beach. In turn, he's connected to Valentin Prodelic, who's the ex-economics court head. So, and he's related to Alexander Dubov, who's an ex-Yulia Tymoshenko MP. So it's, and I mean, that is Team Raider in Odessa. I mean, when you're talking business takeover, Lampochka and team are the team to go to. So
Saakashvili's coming into a different context here. In Georgia, he was coming into the old school Voriv Zakonia context, and he crushed that, and it moved into this more modern criminal. He's coming into Odessa when Odessa's already in this modern criminal element.
You've also got people like Sergei Kivilov, who's obviously well known for rigging the 2004 elections that led to the Orange Revolution. Who owns the court system in Odessa? He's ran the legal university for 15 years. He's the rector. Every prosecutor, every lawyer, every judge that's gone through. He's just been at court himself and been found not guilty by Judge Yaroslava Balin, who's also an associate professor at his university since 2006. I mean, Saakashvili is really up against not only old school mafiosi, but the new educated, shape-shifting always in flux, but always connected leadership. I mean, there is a distinction between your little soldiers that sit around in cafes for hire, which obviously the pro-Russians have used in the past. But it's really is going to be a long time to separate politics from Oblast corruption from crime, because sometimes they're all the same person.
Mark?
Yeah, this is not the era of Isaac Babel's Benya Crick, the nice sort of identifiable gangster chieftain or whatever. Precisely, Adyessa's serious criminals these days wear smart suits, they have businesses, and they all link together, and it becomes very difficult to frankly put a slide of paper, even if it's an arrest warrant, between these separate worlds. And then along comes Saakashvili. The thing is, you might say in Georgia, as Salome has made clear, criminality and corruption had become deeply dysfunctional and a problem for everyone. In Adyessa, precisely because Adyessa is Adyessa, actually, yes, there are all kinds of irksomenesses and day-to-day problems relating to it, but actually part of what has made Adyessa relatively prosperous and what it is has been actually the criminality. And the way that has worked within the system. In so many ways, as it were, in Adyessa, the gangsters are as often almost service providers as they are predators. And I think this is a much, much more interesting but also complex and problematic political environment. And one of the things one can say about Saakashvili is subtlety is not his biggest strongpoint. My concern is precisely if he tries to roll in the way that he did in Georgia, actually all he does is create a situation in which the local elites just simply band together on the principle that basically they feel, look, he's going to ruin the whole thing for us. Because once you start trying to unpick this complex beast that is Adyessan business and politics, essentially, it'll all fall apart.
So all he can do is manage it.
Well, I mean, yeah, he can manage it, but he can create. The key thing is institutions. He needs to create the institutional basis which will slowly wean Adyessa off its former practices, rather than thinking that you can do it by just targeting people and doing the whacker criminal approach, as Nick put it, and targeting people. If you target people, you create a sort of a backlash. Mm. If you create institutions, you create the basis for long-term growth.
Okay. Well, as the only Odessan with us, last word to you, Nick, before we wrap it all up.
No, I would agree with what Mark said entirely. It's the three issues for Odessa and for Ukraine more broadly are rule of law, structure, and sustainability. If it gets those right, even Mark half right, it will at least move towards Romania rather than Russia, mm-hmm. Shall we say, ideologically and functionally, which, depending on whether you see Romania as an improvement or not, I would.
It's an EU member.
I would be honest. But Odessa is in for a very interesting 6 months with all the political dates coming and an awful lot of pressure coming from the Kremlin, I would think, on and off. And whether we can get there with Mr. Saakashvili or not very much depends on the institutions he builds behind him.
Right. All right. Well, and I would argue that with Odessa, we're always in for an interesting ride, not just for 6 months, but probably forever and ever and ever. Amen. That's all we have time for today. So we'll wrap it up. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been Salome Asatiani, a correspondent and popular blogger with RFRL's Georgian Service. Joining us on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University and expert on Russian organized crime and security services and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Joining us via Skype also from Odessa has been blogger and political commentator Nikolai Holmov, author of the blog Odessa Talk. And joining us in spirit and in a virtual sense has been Volodymyr Dubovik, a professor of international relations at Odessa's Mechnikov National University. Thank you all for an interesting and lively discussion.
It's been fun.
It has been
fun. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog, and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.